10600, reel 7.
Mr. John Wainwright, reel 7. You were telling me how the trenches were advanced by stealth prior to the attack on June 4th. I believe you had a story to tell.
Yes, well, the fact was, of course, that the trenches at that time were probably 300 or 400 yards away from the Turkish trenches. And it was decided that our trenches should be much nearer to the Turks before an attack was made. And it was the duty of the people in the front line to send out working parties to dig trenches and eventually to connect these trenches together so there would be a complete line probably within 200 yards of the Turkish trenches. That was the point. And I was given the... Oh, there was one of our working parties had gone out one night and seemingly lost contact with the divisional, with the battalion headquarters. And I remember the sergeant off signals giving me orders to go out with two of the signalers with a reel and telephone, and to go out and find these people, contact them, and give a message back to battalion headquarters, so the steps can be taken to carry on. Well, we went out sometime during the night time. I know it was quite dark when we went out, and we seemed to have some difficulty in finding these people, and it took us longer than we expected. Apart from that, there was intermittent firing going on from the Turkish lines, probably not particularly at us, but we had to be very, very careful in going, so we had to go by quick dashes from one part to another to find some sort of cover. And as I say, it took quite a lot of time to get our bearings and to find out where these people were. Eventually we did, and we got in touch with the battalion headquarters, and we arranged to put some sort of a flag, I think it was, a white flag at one part of the trench, so that it could be seen visually from the front line and be able to work on from there. Well, after this had been done, we were set out for our return journey. But unfortunately, it was becoming light. It was getting light, sort of twilight. And this was the time that both sets of trenches had the stand too, that everybody in the trenches too went on duty there, ready to fire at anything that moved. So we were stuck there in between the trenches for quite a long time, and we found a sort of cover, a depression in the ground, and there was just about room for us to get down. I think I said there were either two or three of us. I forget whether it was two or three. But we just managed to get down with just sufficient cover to keep our heads out of view of the Turk. And we were lying there for most of the day. We just couldn't come back and get back in the daylight. And it was really after stand two that night that we when it was quite dark, that we made our way back to the lines. The point that I remember particularly about this was that when I got back, I thought I'd done quite a good job of work. I remember meeting the signalling sergeant and telling him all, you know, what had happened and all about our adventures. But he noticed when I came back that I had no rifle with me. And whether it was inadvertence or whether deliberate, I don't know. But we had the reel to carry and the telephone and so forth. And we had quite a lot of equipment to carry with us. So anyway, I'd gone without a rifle. And he reported this to the colonel. And I got a ticking off for going out unarmed. So the idea of having done a good job, it was rather dampened. Well, that's the end of that story, anyway.
You mentioned the telephone. That you'd got telephones by then. When did you get them?
Well, this was the first time that we well actually used the telephone.
Had you had any?
We'd had training with the Morse code and so forth, and that sort of with telephones. Where they come from, I don't know, but it was mainly on the Morse code. But this one was a speaking telephone, or you could use the Morse code. But we were instructed to use the Morse code because so that our voices wouldn't be heard at all, you see. That anyway, it wouldn't be as easy to pick up.
What type of telephone was it? Do you remember which pattern?
Oh, I've no idea. I don't remember. It was just a field telephone, and you could either speak or use the Morse code. And that's all that I remember. It was just on a sling, and you carried the thing, and it was it was quite heavy. And the reel too was heavy because we had to have anything up to 400 or 500 yards of cable for the telephone.
The next thing that happened would probably be the June 4th attack. What were you told? How were you briefed about what was to happen in that attack?
Well, my briefing was that I should. Well, I may have mentioned it before, but it was a well known fact anyway. The attack was in two waves there on June 4th. The first wave went over to take the first and second lines of trenches, I think it was. And then there was to be a second wave to go over, which would certainly consolidate the second line of Turkish trenches. And then the first line would go forward and go on towards Kretia, towards Ashibaba there. The hill, which was the main objective there. Because if that high ground was captured, then our people would have command of the Straits of the Dardanelles and would be able to look down on that. But anyhow, that was never accomplished. So anyway, I went out after the attack was timed for 12 noon, and it's funny how little things come back to you. I remember that it was on a Friday too. Whether that was done deliberately because that was the Turkish Sunday, or the Turkish, whatever you call it, ours was a normal Sunday. Friday was a great day for the Turks. And this attack was at noon on that day. So I remember beforehand there we were waiting about for the bombardment. There was a terrific bombardment before the attack. Went on, I don't know how long, half an hour or more. It went on for quite a long time and then paused. And then I remember all the troops were given orders to start yelling and making a big noise and flashing the bayonets. That was that sort of thing. They giving the idea the attack was going to commence. And the idea was to draw the Turks from their support trenches and fully man their front line trenches, which apparently did happen. So the first attack went over at 12 o'clock, and then they went over and captured the first line of trenches.
You mean the bombardment was resumed after you'd done all the shouting?
The bombardment was resumed for a time, then stopped again, and then the attack went on dead on 12 o'clock. And then they went over, and well, it was just hoping that everything was going well. And then the second line went over.
So, did you see what was happening? Did you look over the top to see what was happening?
Or? Well, I mean, we could see the bombardment. I mean, there's no question about it. The Turks would certainly have their heads down the world. It was absolutely a terrific bombardment. I don't know whether there was ever anything like it on the Somme in France or anywhere else. But, I mean, all the batteries on the peninsula were blazing away, and we got the warships. At that time, there was a Queen Elizabeth there, which was one of our top battleships, you know. They were firing 15-inch shells and other battleships there. It was absolutely terrific bombardment. And you could see the shells landing and the dust flying up. Not only were they bombarding the front and second line trench, they were also sending trenches all over to over the behind the trenches, all around Krithia and towards the Elibetsovo. I mean, presumably to deal with the people who were in reserve, that sort of thing. Well, anyway, there were three. I went over as a signalling corporal, and I remember.
Is this in the second wave?
In the second wave, about 10 minutes afterwards.
And can you tell me exactly what you remember about it?
My big man.
What exactly do you remember about
what it? What I remember about it, I remember going over there, and I was carrying the telephone, and I had two people with me. I remember the names. One was Bill Rimmer, from Highfield near Wigan, and the other was Bill Winstonley. They were both members of the Signalling Section, and they went along with me. And one of the things that I do remember, that of course during the attack, there were quite a number of our people who were killed in the first attack, you know, because although there'd been this terrific bombardment, I mean, there still must have been a lot of Turks left in the front line trenches, and there were quite a lot of people, and you see a few people dead lying. And I remember in particular the Captain Leach, who was the company commander of B Company of the 5th Manchester. I remember seeing him lying there, presumably dead. I remember that. And then we got to the line of trenches which had been captured, obviously. And the first thing I went flying into the trenches with this telephone there, and actually I dropped straight onto a dead Turk there, and near to him, I remember quite well, was the second in command of the battalion, who obviously had gone over with the first line, with orders to stay in the first line of the first line captured and report from there and take charge from there. And remember, I reported to him, and he gave me a written message, gave me a message to transmit back to battalion headquarters, and. But to do that, we had to fix up the telephone there. And there again, I remember it quite well, because we wanted an earth connection. And I remember taking the bayonet from this poor Turk who had been killed in this attack, and used that as an earth wire and connected our cable to that for the earth wire. And we sent off messages. Remember the messages about the trenches had been captured, and other their people were going forward, and so on and so forth. And
one of the other signallers had been running the cable out, had they?
Well, yes, they came. We were all together, one after the other. We just tumbled into the trench, you know. I mean, there was no. We just as soon as we got into the trench, we were into it right away. Because there was firing going on, firing all along that, so we were going on, even on the second line. Although the line generally being captured, there were still maybe snipers, a goodness of people in parts of the trench where this fighting was still going on. But where we were, the trench had been definitely captured. And as a thing of progress, then the complete line of trenches was captured, and the Turks had retired, any of them who were left anyway. Anyway, we sent a few messages over. We had some messages from the battalion headquarters giving instructions to Major Fletcher. And then shell came over and just dropped just behind the trenches, and our line went dead. And obviously the wire had been severed, something like that. And we waited a bit, so things were quiet. And I remember one of the chaps volunteered to go out and repair it. Bill Winston, he said, I'll nip out of there if you like and see if I can find where it's corroded. Anyway, Bill went out and he didn't come back again. So I never saw him again. Actually, he must have been killed somewhere, or it was later on, or he got back. But I never saw him again. And then waited again later on. It's later on in the afternoon, and the, the fighting was still going on in front, you know. So our people had advanced and were making good progress towards Krethi. And whilst that was going on, then Bill Rimmer said, well, shall I go out and have a go? So anyway, he went out, and anyway, he scrambled back again there, and so we decided to leave it until dark. So, well, I'm going out. So I went out after dark and found where the land had been fractured and broken, but it made it right, and we got our contact back again to the battalion.
So you didn't move any further forward than that Turkish front
line? No, we stayed with the major there, but it wasn't very, very long before one or two people started straggling back from the front because they got so far forward, you know. And then right on the right of the line, there was the French apparently had been held up on the right of the line. They'd advance in the first place, and then they'd had to retire. And then next to them, on the left of the French brigade or battalion or whatever it was the Royal Naval Division. They'd advance, and then when the French had retired back, or had retired, the Naval Division were left in the air, all being enfiladed on that side. Then they were fighting, they had to retire, which left the Manchester Brigade, which was ours. So we're left right in the air like that, and they had to retire as well.
How did the major keep in touch with what was happening ahead? Did he go forward and come back?
No, he never went forward. There were few people struggled back. I remember in particular one major, I just forget his name now, but there was one of the major, probably C Company, who came over the trench and tumbled in. He was wounded, and he reported to the. So that's about all I remember about that. I remember that he was wounded, but he was able to get back, got back somehow and tumbled into the trench. And he was attended to there, and when things were quiet, he was got back to base. And I remember he gave me a pair of field glasses. I shan't want these again. And he said, you can have those. I remember I used those for the rest of the campaign until I was evacuated. Then I passed them on to someone.
What did you do during the day? I mean, between when you first got there and when you repaired the line?
Well,
you couldn't signal back.
No, well, after that we had to take the line. The line was manned, you know, and you didn't know what was going to happen. You know, we knew these people had gone forward, and we saw some of them straggling back again. Very few of them, by the way. And then it was obvious that the attack had failed, you know, the attack on Krethi had failed. And these people, they hadn't had the support. There had been a real breakthrough there, but there weren't the reinforcements, apparently, to push the line forward and to carry on with it and force their way through. And the people, they were killed and missing and all the rest of it. Some of them struggled back. I remember in particular this major, I forget his name now. Well, we just took our place in the line as ordinary soldiers, you know. We had to take our place with the battalion, and I had a section of the line looking out for any counterattack. Later on, the Turks must have reassembled, you know, opposite where we were, and they came just as it was getting dark at night. That was the stand to period. It was sort of half light, and we could hear the Turks were, I mean, coming with the normal cries of "Illa Allah, Allah," something like that. Was the sort of thing they used to do in the when they were attacking, and we could hear this noise going on. And we just had to beat them off. Now everybody there just firing like mad, and all this, the scenery, crowds, and they're coming. But anyway, that attack was beaten off. And the line was held good, and that remained the line, I mean, for the rest of the campaign, never got beyond there. And as far as I'm concerned, that was the end of the June 4th. but I mean, there was some hard fighting on our left there on the in the vineyard, I remember, and so forth. But the line was held, and that was the end. And to my mind, it all, in retrospect, it seemed to be the end of the campaign as far as Hell is was concerned. There was never any real attempt for another attack. The main reason, presumably, is because we didn't get the reinforcements. And the casualties have been pretty, very heavy during that attack. We hadn't had the reinforcements, and then it was just a case of holding on after that, as far as my opinion, anyway.
What happened immediately after that night, and you beat off the counterattack? What happened then?
Well, we carried on. We were in the we stayed on in the line there. That was after the late. That was after the June 6th that I was promoted to platoon sergeant. I finished then with the signalers, and our signal section was more or less disbanded, except for the sergeant and one or two other people who kept in touch with the brigade. You see, going further back. But
what about you? You had a rest period in Imbros, I think. Was that before?
That was after. We were in the trenches probably, I don't know, a week or more. And then the battalion was withdrawn, and we went to Imbros for a week. I mean, for a week's rest, presumably.
What was morale like in the battalion after such a defeat?
Well, of course, it was a shock in some ways, because we knew right from the very beginning that we were in for a hard fight there. And we had a lot of casualties even before that. A lot of sniping went on and all the other guys going out and getting the trenches built for ready for the attack. People were being killed and wounded all along the line. I remember quite a number of casualties were going on. But in the attack itself, I mean, it was a shock to lose so many of the people that you had known. Well, I'd only been in for probably less than 2 years, but a lot of the lads who joined up about the same time as I had were killed on that day. And but then, I suppose, after a rest, we knew it was a job that had to be done, and we went back again.
Now, you went back. Did you go back into the same section of the line?
We were off and on in that section of the line until after the 6th and 8th of August.
Now, you were promoted to platoon sergeant.
Yeah.
Was that still within A Company?
I was in A Company, my old company, my original company.
And what was your job as platoon sergeant? Could you just briefly run through your duties and responsibilities?
Well, in the line, and that was the main thing anyway, that in the line you had a section of the trenches under your command. There would be a second lieutenant in charge of a section. There'd be a section, wasn't known as a section, the second lieutenant, but that officer was in charge of the section. I was there as platoon sergeant there. We had a section of the line to there, and we had to man that line. We had to have a stand to every available man was on the firing parapet ready for any eventualities. And then on stand down, it used to be two on and four off. So you'd have one man and three during on duty or in firing position in the line during the night.
Was it your responsibility then to set those guard
duties? It was my duty to set them off and give them what instruction they were, what they were to do, and to travel along the section and see that each man was at his post and have a word with them as they went on and so on. So you're really in charge of that part of the line.
What were the standard instructions for the sentries? What were they?
Well, the standard instruction was that you've got to keep your eyes open and always be prepared for a surprise attack or for raiding parties, anything like all that sort of thing, you know. And the man had orders if he saw something moving, and he wasn't sure that he had the authority to fire it. He hadn't to wait for any orders. He would fire it if he thought he saw someone coming.
Did the men have trouble staying awake?
No, I never remember anybody having trouble at all. And even I suppose in the period, because you seem to get your rest, you doze off. Because I mean, you just sat down on the firing step or anywhere and just rested. I mean, there was nothing else to do during the night time. So you're always available to take up your place, take up your place in the line.
What other jobs did you have as platoon sergeant besides setting the sentries?
Well, the thing was, I mean, to see that the men were as far as possible, that the trenches were kept clean and tidy, that the men looked after their rifles and cleaned the rifles each day. Because, I mean, apart from the outside of the rifle, when the rifles had been fired, there was always a bit of carbon, something left in the barrel. And we had a what was called a pull-through, was a cord with some sort of abrasive material on the end, like which you used to draw through the barrel to clean the barrel. And then we used to put a little bit of oil through that sort of thing. And the mode of testing the barrel was for the man to open his bolt, and you just put your thumbnail in, but hold it to the light, and by looking down the barrel, you could see the barrel shining, whether it was clean or not. So I mean, that was one of the jobs, to make quite certain that their weapons were ready for action, the rifles were all right and clean, and that they were got ammunition. What ammunition when used during the night, you make sure that it was replaced. The men had so many rounds of ammunition each. The rifles were always a one clip in, five cartridges in any time in the line, ready for firing. And you know, the remainder of the was in the pouches that we had in our bandoliers. There were bandoliers at that time.
Anything else you had to do?
Well, we had to receive the rations. The rations used to come up from the quartermaster sergeant. Had a store just behind the lines. He got the share of the company from the battalion, and then they would dish it out. So you'd send somebody there for your share of the rations, and the rations were all dry rations, you know.
You told us, so many tin
of bully beef each.
So the platoon sergeant would distribute it amongst
you? You'd do your own section, yes. And there would be a Lance Corporal or somebody there. Any other NCOs in this section would help on this. And the men used to cook the things in the trenches.
Anything else you had to do?
Well, I don't know. The thing was, is anybody wounded? I mean, you had to do a bit of first aid and all that sort of thing. And see, there were people badly wounded. You see the stretcher bearers were there. I mean, I remember one or two while we were in the line one time. I remember one or two incidents where I remember a man being pretty badly wounded in the hand was pretty well shattered. I remember putting a tourniquet on his wrist. That was on the pressure point on the wrist. Another two poor chap, I remember he was badly wounded. He just got in the throat. And another man there was wounded. He's shot in the head. I remember putting a bandage on. All that sort of thing. You had to just look after your men and get, if they were wounded, I mean, see they were attended to and see they get back to the first aid post.
How did you get on with the men as a sergeant? Did it change your relationship with them?
Oh, no, you got on very well with them. I mean, there was not a great lot of formality. I mean, you were given your place as a sergeant and so forth. But, I mean, there's no such things as having drill in the trenches and all that sort of thing.
Were you on first name terms in the trenches, in the front line, or would you be Sergeant Wainwright?
Oh, yes, they'd always address you. They always give you a rank of sergeant or whatever it was. But, I mean, as far as the men were concerned, it wasn't a case of private somebody or there. You just knew them, like Bill Winstonley, right on. And that was Bill. You just addressed them by their Christian name.
How about the officers? How was responsibility divided between you and the second lieutenant?
Well, the officers were somewhere in the they never had a front line position. Their dugout or trench was somewhere just behind the front line, and to some extent they were inclined to be rather remote. I always thought they're. And they would just sort of come around the lines in the daytime and just wander around and see that everything was all right. And of course, they had to get reports out to the.
So you deal with the day-to-day things, and the officers would just check that you were doing your job, in a sense.
Yes, we had to report each day on the number of men actually in our section, and pass it on. So anybody been wounded or gone back sick or anything of that sort of thing.